is the One Ocean Hub podcast.
Hello and welcome to the fourth episode of the One Ocean Hub podcast, our series of conversations about various interrelationships of ocean and the humankind. My name is Milica Prokic and I'm a knowledge exchange associate with the One Ocean Hub. I'm an environmental historian, artist, and an island enthusiast. And with me today are Kira Irving. Hello, Kira.
Hello, lovely to be here with you today.
Lovely to have you. And Alsemi Olwahe. Hi, Alsemi.
Hi, so nice to be here today.
Yeah, it's wonderful to have you both. I'm just going to say a couple of words to introduce you both because I'm super excited to talk to you and about your projects and about your bond to One Ocean Hub. So I'm just going to introduce you a little bit to our listeners. And I'm going to say a couple of things about how your projects came to be. So Kira, you're a sociologist and monitoring, evaluation, research and learning lead at The Groundwork. Kira, could you tell us what Groundwork is and what it does?
Yeah, sure, Melissa. So I am moving to Groundwork actually next year. Uh-huh. I've been in academia for many years, and I'm moving from the Urban Future Center at the Durban University of Technology to a longtime partner, actually, Groundwork, which is an environmental justice organization in South Africa.
Oh, brilliant. And you also work as an associate professor at the Durban University of Technology.
I'm still holding association, which I think is important. And it means I get to also see through my supervision with some of my amazing students that I'm lucky to supervise.
Oh, that's fantastic. And Kira, what I'm absolutely thrilled to talk to you about today is that you use creative participatory methods. You collaborate with colleagues in the arts. Your current collaboration with the One Ocean Hub includes work with Amphitheater and on Lalela Ulwantle, or Listen to the Sea in KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa. And there you engage with the notions of interdisciplinary approaches, the politics of storytelling, and embodied engagements in thinking about and with ocean. And this is what I'm particularly thrilled to talk to you about today. Alsemi, you're a social anthropologist and researcher, and you're currently a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Namibia in Windhoek. And you hold a doctorate in social and cultural anthropology from the University of Cologne, is that right?
Yes, that's right, yeah. Finished that, or let's say handed it in 2020 and published it in 2022, yes. So I did my bachelor's actually at Stellenbosch University and then moved my postgraduate studies to University of Cape Town, also in anthropology.
Oh, fantastic. Brilliant. And you, your interest is in transdisciplinary methods and environmental humanities and then legal and political anthropology, which I find a fascinating cluster of interests and activities. That's brilliant. And Alsemi, you joined One Ocean Hub recently this year, in 2023. Uh-huh.
Yes, I joined in February or January, let's say, this year. So I'm quite new in the project.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And you focus on the politics and practices of ocean culture and heritage. And that's the bond with the hub, yeah?
Yes, exactly.
Fantastic. And today I'm super, super, super thrilled to talk to you about your projects with the Topnar community in Walvis Bay.
I'm working generally with the Topnar community, which is a very heterogeneous, diverse community.
So, yeah, today we're going to talk about your arts-based and transdisciplinary research projects which have been co-conceptualized and co-developed with the local communities. So in Namibia and in KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa. And about the transdisciplinary methods and arts-based methods and artwork outcomes of this collaborative work. And both of your projects also involve work with youth. Both are arts-based methods and both have artworks as outcomes. Both are of them harbor storytelling, embodied and intergenerational aspects as well. And this is something that I think we all are super excited to learn more about today. And I'm going to start with a question to you, Alcimi, and about the background of the Topnar Community Youth Project and the story of the Topnar displacement or their perceived disconnect with the ocean from the decision maker's point of view. So the group that we're talking about today has been displaced from the coast, although they are called the sea people, right? Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, thanks. Maybe let me start by saying that this project was conceptualized within the context of One Ocean Hub Namibia, and it emerged from my colleagues at University of Namibia. They did a couple of baseline and exploratory work in the years prior. And in consulting with different, let's say, knowledge holders at the coast, which mostly involved people that could be considered to have been previously marginalized or socioeconomically marginalized. And they identified also the Topnar community as kind of falling in this cluster of coastal residents. And consulting, I mean, I think perhaps also to say it is problematic to use the term community often, because it is, of course, it is more complicated in terms of who gets involved in these kind of consultations and so on. But generally, in their engagement with different stakeholders within the Topnar, there was a need expressed for this relationship to the ocean or their fishing heritage and their heritage connected to coastal places, for those stories to be told. So when I stepped into One Ocean Hub, through various, let's say, discussions, it was decided that I will assist Mr. Glenn Casper, who is a junior counselor in the traditional authority, but he's also a key member of the Topnar Youth Association. And just, he's very passionate about Topnar identity, Topnar heritage and history. So he, together with, again, another colleague of mine, they wrote a proposal together and they started this project, the Hurunin Project. Because the Hurunin especially were seen as a kind of sub-clan or subgroup within that primarily resided in some of the coastal places. But as I said, this is also a history that is still being uncovered, contested, reconstructed. So I think it's also a process from the ground up of reclaiming these kind of lost identities and access to places. And to come to your second question, basically, again, I think what has been my primary role also is trying to support the Hurunin Project with some literature review, historical research to better understand and really identify some of the key processes that have contributed to this displacement, or let's say perceived displacement. And I think it is a very complex history. And what makes it complicated is because a lot of people historically along the coast engaged in mobile land use and land relations. So that would mean seasonal use of resources between the coast and between the inland, especially along the ephemeral rivers, which are rivers that only flow with flood events, with rain events. So what I'm trying to say is that not always were people permanently settled at the coast, but there were perhaps some that were. But then that made it easier for people to that made it easier from the perspective of the colonial gaze to say that the place is uninhabited, because it doesn't reflect the patterns of habitation that perhaps the incoming colonial regime could identify. So that was one kind of level of the erasure. But then, of course, with the onset of colonialism, apart from viewing the landscape as empty, without people, without cultural relation, the subsequent colonial wars and genocide also emptied the landscape eventually.
So basically the perceived or sort of like the harnessing of the perception of the emptiness of the landscape that was set off by the lack of understanding of how the landscape is inhabited.
Yes.
Sort of brought this about, okay. And could you tell us just a tiny little bit more about your role in prodding into these perceptions and the impact of these perceptions and the harnessing of the perceptions from the point of view of the colonial authority?
Sure. Yeah, sorry, I get sidetracked with the histories often. But yeah, to keep it basically short, I think in contemporary Namibia, it's important to note that generally the coastal zone, including the ocean, is still perceived as being empty of cultural relations, social relations, and also claims. And this is being really reinforced by the fact that the whole coast is a conservation area. It's three subsequent national parks. Again, histories that stretch back to the colonial era. But this perception of the coast being empty of these claims, of these relations, have meant that a lot of the histories are erased. A lot of the kind of alternative, let's say, also indigenous and more Creole forms of knowing the landscape, of knowing the place and the environment has also been erased. And again, this feeds into decision-making processes because as long as there's this perception that Namibians do not have a cultural connection to the ocean or a so-called traditional connection to the ocean, then it's politically justifiable not necessarily to include coastal residents within processes of decision-making, including, for example, marine spatial planning or the blue economy. And I think things are definitely shifting in the last years, but it's still it's still a space that remains dominated by commercial and state and powerful interests. Yes.
So do we know the sort of time period when this displacement or when this emptying took place? Was it a one sweep? Did it unfold over some decades, or when were we able to start monitoring it, looking back into the past, into history, or historical?
Again, I think it is quite complex, and like you said, I think it happened in various. Of course, you can identify some key historical moments, but I think it's important to note also that there were multiple colonial regimes overlapping along the coast. So the area in which the Topinary historically live and continue to live, it was a British enclave during the German colonial period and primarily governed by the Cape Colony, through the Cape Colony. And then subsequently, it did get integrated into Southwest Africa, after German colonial period, when South Africa then annexed Namibia. But then in the 70s, it once again was an enclave incorporated back into South Africa. So that part of the coast has a very different history than, for example, the neighboring urban area. So I think that generally, of course, the 1904 to 1908 German colonial war and genocide played a major role. That history is also a history that a lot of people are contesting in terms of recognition at the coast of the heritage. So, for example, a lot of the concentration camps were at the coast, in the southern part of the coast, and these sites are still not properly recognized. The role of slavery and of migrant labor in the construction of the urban coastal centers is not adequately recognized, you know. And I think the Topinary story, again, fits in this broader picture. Where they are, their recognition in terms of land and resource rights are intersecting as well, because generally they do not have any customary land rights at the moment because they live in two national parks. And most of the coastal places that is connected to their heritage is also falling in national parks or restricted areas. So, you know, there's this kind of denial of, let's say, coastal belonging and land relations and claims in this context.
And then access.
And access.
Yeah, so I think that that would be like it's a fascinating story because it's a it's incredibly complex.
It's very complex.
Yeah, but at the same time, you have this bond to the ocean that's both a lifeline. It's sort of a part of a crucial part of the identity, but it's sort of both the boon and the bane of the existence of these communities. And this notion of access, I think, brings me to, or is a nice link to your project, Kira, I think, because in KwaZulu-Natal, these relations to the ocean play out in their own way, but I think that they build on this notion of access historically. So Kira, would you be able to tell us a little bit about problematizing the project of Lalela Ulwantle, Listen to the Sea, how it came about, or what is the origin story, or what is what you wanted to problematize with it?
Yeah, sure. And it certainly has some similarities to the story that Osama is telling us now. You know, South Africa's history of colonialism, but also apartheid, in which segregation was engineered spatially in quite violent forms, has meant that, you know, depending on how your history and how you've been racialized, either with forms of privilege or oppression, really has mediated to some extent people's ability to access coastlines or feel secure, you know, in being able to be on the beach or in the sea. But Lalela Ulwantle starts actually from a much more contemporary concern, but one that certainly has its historical roots in forms of colonial extraction, and that is around mining. In this case, sort of prospecting for oil and gas off the coastline, on the eastern coastline of South Africa, so just off the city of Durban where I'm based. And here access is also around access to decision-making forums, or having some say, and it's not just actually, you know, to have a voice, but to have a voice that is taken seriously. So it actually shapes decision making. And we had an Italian oil and gas company who had partnered with a South African company to prospect for gas. And environmental justice organization had called a meeting of coastal people to share their concerns and to ask questions of the Petroleum Agency of South Africa, who's a kind of state mediating body who gives the licenses to go ahead to prospect or to drill. And it was actually in that meeting, which I had been asked by the environmental justice organization to mediate, that I really felt like what I was watching is a kind of narrowing or shrinking of people's voices into this homogenous group called the community. And Alsamay was saying earlier that this notion of the community can be very problematic. And when it's used in this way, in which it sort of silences the diversity of concerns, and it sets up an artificial binary of community versus big business, often big business interests win. And this was the same thing that happened in this case, where they were given the go-ahead to prospect. That actually turned into a legal case, which ultimately stopped the prospecting. But in that room, there was such a sense that we, and when I say we, I mean South Africans, really needed to start to listen to each other closely and hear the kind of the difference, but what was also shared concerns, and how in recognizing actually our history and the kinds of injustices which were perpetuated then and continue to be reproduced now, we might find forms of solidarity that enabled us to work across these differences so that we could have a more powerful decision-making voice when it came to what was happening in our oceans.
fantastic. So like it's what you just said sort of led us to the point where I wanted to ask you about how did this solidarity and co-understanding and co-creating of methods to understand the complexity of the situation and the means to have own impact on it, to claim the place at the table, decision-making table, and to influence the decision-making through arts-based, transdisciplinary, community-based, if I may say community in this context, and how did it land, this collaboration? How did it land on arts-based methods, research methods? And how did it land, how did it develop transdisciplinarily? What would be my question.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, how it comes to be arts-based, I think it's because I already had a strong working relationship with MP Theatre. And we had worked on previous projects around different social justice issues with, and it was a wonderful sort of synchronicity that the One Ocean Hub arrives in South Africa and that Dylan McGarry is already a part of those sort of deliberations around ocean governance and justice. And he and I met at a workshop looking at theatre-based research. And we got speaking around this meeting that I've just been explaining. And I think both of us come from Durban and we were like, I think we've got to do something about this, you know. Could we explore this? You know, what would happen if we, and the theatre work is always research-based theatre, so the first stage has to be research-led. We were interested in understanding people's relationship with the ocean because so much policy work, particularly around marine spatial planning and ocean economy master plans, is dominated by the knowledge that is generated either through economic models or through scientific models. And we felt that whilst, of course, there's value to that way of knowing something, that is certainly not the only way in which humans make sense of their world, and neither is it always the most important. And so the research really started with a very simple question, which was to ask the people who we wanted to speak to, what was their first memories of the ocean? And from there, you really got a sense of what the kind of symbolic, spiritual, cultural and social meaning that feeling, that living so close to the ocean weaves for people. And it really does do that. It gives them, it's their sense of history, it's their sense of belonging. It feels very much integral to people's being in this part of the world, as I'm sure it does for many coastal people. Yeah, so that's how we started.
Yeah, and then most fascinatingly and importantly and crucially, there are in this storytelling exercise that you had first of people telling their own memory or their own bond with the ocean, came the narrative or came the notion of the custom and what the ocean means to certain communities, and what are historical and customary bonds of certain peoples, coastal peoples in KwaZulu-Natal to the ocean. And the group came together to co-create the story called Lalela Ulwantle, Listen to the Sea. Could you tell us a little bit more about these particular aspects?
So we spoke to many, many different people who, you know, relate to the sea in various forms of livelihoods and various forms of cultural practice, and even in forms of sort of what one would be consider leisure or pleasure. So, you know, marine scientists, environmental activists, lifeguards, sangomas, and in this part of the world, a sangoma would be like a traditional healer or someone who is able to facilitate communication between this world and the world of the ancestors, and also to fishers who were fishing, women, men, children. So, I mean, what's always so exciting is that when you start from someone's sense of what the ocean means, rather than imposing what you think it should be into the question, you really get the rich sort of politics of how humans negotiate sort of social power dynamics and how these histories mediate our understanding of the oceans and what we think should happen in terms of how humans should be interacting with them. So for Lalela Owandle, you know, there's a large, rich, qualitative data set, for lack of a better word. It's really narrative data. And with Neil Coppin and Mpumi Mtubeni, who are the other two directors of Amphitheatre with Dylan, wove in three characters who become composite characters. In other words, the character holds many people's voices. It's not based just on one person. And to some extent, because we are in KwaZulu-Natal, they mirror some of the social dynamics here. So the one character tells an intergenerational story of a family who arrived here through indentured labor. So bringing indentured laborers from India in the 1800s, and just how important their contribution has been to fishing and livelihoods and subsistence in our city. The second story is the story of Nawandle, who's also, it tells three generations of women's stories around sort of traditional Zulu ancestral belief, around, since colonialism, the integration of ancestral belief with forms of Christianity, and then how marine science and caring for the ocean does not have to be antithesis to those belief systems. In fact, in a way, the Nawandle's character models the possibility for integrating Indigenous knowledge and scientific knowledge in thinking about how we might protect our oceans and her well-being. And then the third character is very much rooted in the marine science and holds forms of privilege. She's racialized as a white woman growing up here and having to, in one sense, grapple with what that means. But secondly, also, she shows too that scientists can often have a similar sense of awe and wonder, kind of magical experience within their own discipline, which can make them become more politicized around what should and shouldn't happen in the ocean.
Fantastic. And these characters came about from people sitting together and sharing stories iteratively. So your data set is actually layer upon layer of storytelling. This is another sort of link or another point of overlap that El Semi's project with the Topnar people has, how it links with the amphitheater work and the Lalela Owandle. So El Semi, I would like to bring you in here, and if you could tell us a little bit about this around the fire stories that were a part of your quote unquote data set, and the experience, this transdisciplinary experience that you had listening to these stories, making sense of them, and co-making sense of them with the people who told them.
Yes, sure. I think maybe first also just to say that it was so nice listening now to Kira, because I think a lot of the things really resonate between South Africa and Namibia. Of course, we have a shared history, especially around these questions of race and, let's say, spatial segregation. So when we're also talking about, you know, looking at storytelling as a method, it's, I think, also important to keep in mind that, you know, me as a white Namibian, I also step into a space with that positionality, you know. So I think that becomes part of the method also of, you know, trying to be reflective of what that does to the dynamics between people in that particular time and space, and what that maybe also brings up in terms of, you know, knowledge production around the ocean. but to answer your question with the around the fire methodology, unfortunately, at this stage, I have been engaging with it marginally. I'm hoping next year that it will expand, just because it's sometimes there's also just a slow process of familiarizing yourself with people, with a context, and trying to understand how you can actually co-research or co-produce knowledge instead of just stepping in and extracting, which is often the case in research. So I think, of course, we are also working in a difficult timeline, but because it was a quite a grassroots driven process, the first events that did take place presented some tensions in the community. So it had to be put on hold also for a couple of months. And again, I think this is also very important reflections, because it shows again that when we're dealing with transformative based research, or we want to facilitate transformative based research, it's also process based, and it often doesn't fit neatly into timelines. but I think just from working with the youth, maybe just to add to that, it has been wonderful to at least see or to hear from them how this intergenerational dialogue that was happening around the fire was igniting both the elders and the youth, because this is a context where seniority or hierarchical relations are still quite strong. And a lot of the elders and a lot of the youth were very excited about having opportunities again to actually have mutual conversations and to learn about the history, and to be brought together as well, because apparently there has been a lack in that regard. So that was, for me, very interesting to see how that also, for example, for the youth brought up questions around knowing the ocean that they didn't know before, such as that some of the elders were sharing that the ocean is male and female for some, or things like this, you know, that before they were never exposed to. So that was, it was an interesting moment of reigniting cultural memory as well.
That's fantastic. I really appreciate, Alcimi, that you answered the question that I wanted to pose to both of you, actually. But it's about the challenges in transdisciplinary research. What I really always appreciate is when researcher candidly speaks to these challenges that sometimes take time to surmount, first of all, and second of all, it's really precious to hear from someone who is in fact early on in the early phases into the project, which you are at the moment. And at the same time, you told us about the positive notions of your research that come about in this early stage as well, which is this intergenerational rekindling of old stories that might, if this process hasn't started, that they could have been lost or forgotten or unignited. So that is really inspiring to hear. So thank you for this. And I would like to sort of build on this and ask Kira also about some challenges that you guys had in your collaboration through Empathy Theater in KwaZulu-Natal. Do you see any overlaps, or are there any stories from your side to tell about the challenges and the overcoming of challenges and the unexpected stories or aspects of the research?
But for us, because we had early on partnered with environmental justice organizations who were opposed to oil and gas in the oceans from the beginning for what we believed was very good reason. And especially when you think about the history of mining in our country, although for Alsame this will be the same, is that you really have, you couldn't find more clear examples of the total exploitation of not just natural resources, but of human labor, and very much the kind of inequality that has been reproduced time and time again in South Africa can be traced back to histories of mining. So when you're working in a transdisciplinary project, it's not just about interdisciplinary work, but you're working with organizations who are sitting outside of the academy. And the kind of political intention that they are wanting from the work, and which you might support as a researcher, in this case, we did, that can be rewarding in itself. Of course, it can be a challenge for some of the other researchers who are sitting in the broader project, who may not wish to take such a hard political stand against mining in the oceans, for example. So that, I think, was really interesting, because in a way, as researchers, we had to navigate what did that mean. And I think over the 5 years that the hub's been together, it's been quite exciting. There's clearly a much bigger shift against ocean seabed mining overall, but it didn't necessarily feel like that's where it started. So you're accountable, of course, to the research project and to the sort of funding objectives. But when you're doing participatory action research, you are also first and foremost accountable to the participants and to project partners who are sitting in social justice or environmental justice movements. So it was interesting. I think we learned a lot around navigating that. There was once or twice where we actually got asked, this is by outside organizations, not the One Ocean Hub, whether we'd be prepared to take things out of our script, because they were worried that it might be, it might offend big commercial fisheries, for example. And there too, you have to make a call. So for us, we were like, no, I'm sorry, we're not prepared to do that. This is not a story that can just be altered. This is a type of verbatim theater making. So, these stories actually come from what people have shared in their own words. So the ethics of sort of picking the ones that you think are palatable for an audience just really isn't a viable proposition. So we were quite lucky that even when we did push back, we were still allowed into those spaces, which I think is important. And it's important to have and listen to difficult conversations, because that is the complexity of where we are at the moment. And if we aren't able to sit with that and think through it, then really, we're just coming up with sort of simplistic solutions that often perpetuate the inequalities that already exist on the ground.
Yeah, thank you so much for this. This is fantastic. So the challenges that you on your end were facing were the political positionalities of researchers and participants, which is indeed a big thing, right? Because it sort of shatters the assumption or the claim that a researcher can be apolitical, especially when it comes to this kind of live research that binds together decision making in the present that's set off by the entire history of the area, of the country, and of the coast in this part. Two things, I think. So what came out of the research, and I appreciate that, Elsimi, you have your, as we said, it's a young project, it's nascent, and it's sort of like just coming out with its first outputs in the form of two documentaries. And then La Lela had its life already. It's got a couple of iterations. One of them was a radio drama or a podcast. One of them is an animation, which we're going to link into in the description of the podcast, as well as the documentary that came out from the Topnar Elsimi. But yeah, La Lela had a podcast, it had an animation, it had a theater piece that was performed at the UN in New York at the World Ocean Day this June. It had one of the most prestigious, if not the most prestigious awards, called Flower of the Cape.
Yeah.
It was submitted as evidence in court and had its own impact in decision making directly. So I would like to first ask you about the impact in the world or the engagement with the projects in the world as they came out in this composite arts-based and arts-led methodology. So to land the question a bit, the impacts of your project so far, Elsimi, on your side as a young and nascent project, and Kira, on your side as the project that's lived in the world in this complex way for a while now?
No, thanks. I think, looking at impact is important. And in one way, we've been so fortunate in that the One Ocean Hub has supported this kind of reflective work. So now, as we reach the end of the sort of funded project, we're able to look back and ask those questions around impact. And maybe just to say that, and I know I've said this before, but what you can attribute to something that has been generated and what your output has contributed to other movements, I think is also important. So, and here I just want to talk a little bit about the court cases as an example. One of the things that I think has been the most sort of exciting for us is just to remember that arts-based approaches, whilst they really do make research and their kind of critical narrative that you're wanting more and more people to start sort of grappling with, they make it more accessible. They make it more engaging. I think also, Melissa, your thing, it's embodied to some extent rather than just reading an academic publication. But it's so important equally to do that in a way in which you are in a network of other actors who are roughly also moving towards these same sort of questions. So if you're fortunate enough to have your arts-based methods embedded in social movements, then it opens up your, I don't know, for lack of a better word, your sort of like your outputs or your practice or your knowledge generation products for use by others. And this is very important because it allows other actors to shape with your contribution sort of new lines of inquiry or new statements that they want to put out in their sort of political struggles. So in that case, so La Lela, I would say we can't attribute any sort of legal processes to the product itself. But what did happen along the way is that, for example, SETSI, who's the South Durban Community Environmental Alliance, who was directly taking on oil and gas issues in the ocean, they used some of the feedback forms that we would do with audience members to show that intangible heritage is actually very important in the oceans. And it's not just shipwrecks or sort of, you know, the caves with human remains, that in fact, ancestral belief is very much linked up with the water cycle and particularly with the oceans, and that that should also be protected. So I think along the way, you know, other sort of allies who we're working with and activists, in one affidavit, they used as a sort of reference some of this. But in my view, you know, the very brave small-scale fishers and coastal communities were actually the people who took on big oil and gas in those legal court cases. That a few people thought that Lalela would be useful in their struggle is wonderful, but in that case, it's really led by the people on the ground who are taking on those issues.
Yeah, so I think that's a beautiful answer to my question of how do you see or what do you see as an impact of such a transdisciplinary collaborative co-production, knowledge co-production as it lives in the world. Most recently, Lalela Olwandle was nominated for the Times Higher Education Award, or One Ocean Hub was nominated for International Collaboration of the Year for the collaboration with the Amphitheatre and on specifically on Lalela Olwandle. Yes, it's just a beauty to behold that such a project, when it takes off and when it takes a life of its own, has so much impact on the world. And that it can be attributed by to the people that you've just credited now. And I want to sort of in that vein, I want to ask Alcimi to tell us about sort of like the very, very early days of the life that the People of the Sea documentary took as it came out a couple of weeks ago, actually. So we're talking about nascent. Did you have any feedback? What was your experience of it coming out into the world? And what are some main messages and takeaways from it?
Yes, sure. Again, this documentary, or it's not really a documentary, but a short, let's say a short film. It was driven really by the One Ocean Hub side, but then also by Mr. Glenn Casper, who's the key person, the key narrator in the film. And I think it really, it's a film that tells his story and his journey. And I think that's important to note, but also it does tell it in a way that I think will resonate with other people in his community. So I think as Kira also said, you know, this process of knowledge co-production is also this ongoing, it's an ongoing process, you know, of establishing, co-establishing matters of concern between, you know, different stakeholders. And for me also, in terms of my role, understanding, trying to understand what are the diverse perspectives coming out. And I think in terms of impact, this film definitely is going to open conversations. I hope so. Even if it's debate or contestation, or it is definitely, there are very heterogeneous perspectives around people's connection to the ocean, what kind of connection that is, what that means for decision making, and also what people understand needs to be done in terms of, let's say, repatriation or in terms of access. There, it's really a diverse diversity, you know. So, but I think films like that, what the power that they carry is at least to open a dialogue that hasn't been there before. And again, like Kira said as well, in the Namibian context, the dialogue around intangible cultural heritage of the ocean and of the coastal zone is still nascent as well. And it certainly does play a huge role in terms of public knowledge and public dialogue and engagement in our major extractive industries, which are many situated at the coast. This includes mining and commercial fisheries and mining on land as well as marine mining. So again, you know, I think there is that bigger picture that we're hoping at least the foundations are being laid at different levels in terms of stirring up some other ways of perceiving human ocean relations and also our coastline.
You were talking about the entanglements between or of tangible and intangible, material and transmaterial. For the lack of a better word, abstract and embodied. And I really want to sort of pick your brains about the notion of embodiment, because it comes out really strongly in your inquiry. So you have this embodied notion of access of interrelation of the human and the ocean, from the leisure and pleasure through like an embodied contact of the human, direct contact of the human and the ocean. Then you have this corporal and transmaterial tensions of indentured labor and the human muscle power and embodied work. And the extracted commodity in mining or in fishery. You have the physical dislocation of the community or the cutoff of the access of this flow of coastal inland movement in Namibia. And then you have the embodied performance of somebody speaking, of taking the stage and saying certain things that come out of these story sharing processes. So these are several different ways of embodiment, of how embodiment comes through in your research. Could you reflect a little bit on it? What is the most important to you? Which one came through the strongest, and what is the role of embodiment in your inquiries?
I mean, I'm not trained in theatre or drama, but I have, by lucky circumstances, worked now for many years with people who are. And with Lalelo or Wandle, I feel, rather than think, that there is the power of, you know, asking the audience to feel these stories whilst being there in their bodies, and then enabling afterwards that post-performance discussion in which you can also speak into the story and express how it's made you feel. There is something powerful in that. I feel like it's difficult to sort of articulate what that is, but the emotive sort of shift or movement that happens for many people in the audience, I think it's important. And it just, you know, in a country in which you do have such inequality and you still have such strong sort of fractures around race and class and gender and even cultural understandings, that seems to open up like a curtain between polar opposites, like where you don't have to be so married to your view of the world anymore. There's you're able to find a way in to imagine and almost you know, understand the importance of another way of being. So I feel that performance is quite, it's a wonderful method for doing that, for breaking down kind of binary ideas or polarized debates. Of course, you have to really design it and plan it with that intention at heart. It doesn't just happen. So MP Theatre is very skilled at doing that. But I feel like that's why it's a useful political tool too, to say, no, it's okay. We can have these difficult conversations and you can have them in a slightly different way, in which you feel the benefit of listening more carefully to each other.
Yeah, and it happens physically and it happens in the bodies of the performers and of the audience. Alcimi, what's the role of the body or of the embodiment in your research, and how did it come out in this project?
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating topic as well for me. I think, like you've pointed out, there are so many different layers to that idea, to the concept. But I think in the Namibian context, and I'm sure Kira can relate in the South African context as she just said, I feel that methodologically embodiment becomes a political practice as well, as much as an approach. But I think when we look now specifically at ocean culture and heritage, a lot of the erasure that has happened in the Namibian context, it's also related to a kind of broader imposition of certain regimes of truth in terms of how we relate to each other, but also to our environments, which has been quite alienating, you know, and which has been imposed, of course, during colonial, but especially also apartheid rule. So I think it's connected to this kind of separation between certain bodies and certain persons, and who is human and who is not human, that racial ideology. But I think that racial ideology also permeated the environment, and that separation that got institutionalized. So I think thinking about embodiment, it's also about how can we politically embody other ways of being towards more, towards, of course, reconciliation, but also towards, understanding difference, engaging with difference, opening up spaces where, understanding can be fostered, learning can be fostered, but also reclaiming perhaps other ways of knowing that were intentionally suppressed or erased during our history. And of course, we're talking a lot about the past, but I think also the current economic system that we're living in reinforces again these separations between people, separations between the environment and people. So I think embodiment for me is also about trying to kind of deconstruct that power, but in particular places, because again, it's that materiality of place that also comes into play that I also find interesting, because again, the Namibian coast is very specific. It's maybe to bring it a little bit more to the ground, with the research that I'm doing, it's also taking place in Walvis Bay, which is the main deep sea port, which was constructed in the Kwisep Delta and river. And this is where originally a lot of the Topna communities traced their descendants, or let's say history, to. They are the kind of original inhabitants also of Walvis Bay. So it's also an urbanized coastal history. So really also trying to understand how processes of urbanization, especially apartheid-driven urbanization, fostered our connection to the coast, to the shoreline, to the ocean.
You said, I just can't help but following up with this. You said that the materiality of the environment plays a crucial role there in that embodied interrelation of the humans and the environment. And you said that it's specific. What is the specificity of the Namibian environment in its material manifestation that makes this bond that specific?
Again, I will speak from the space where I'm working, which is Walvis Bay and the surrounds. But I think the first aspect is, of course, it's a dry land, it's a desert, it's hyper-arid. And that in itself, it let's say it enforced constraints on the colonial project in terms of extraction, in terms of colonization as well. But it has been viewed, just to give an example, from very, I think, different logics, because perhaps from the colonial logic, it was really seen as this hyper-arid, inhospitable environment that has to be tamed, that has to be controlled, and somehow, this fantasy of, how do you say, conquering, yeah. But if you look perhaps from the Tupinambá history, what I find is, at least in the literature and some of my early encounters, it's a very different perspective. It's one of flourishing, of abundance, because it was viewed from this perspective of the ephemeral rivers that cut across the landscape, but also from the abundant coastline, which is a very fertile ocean. So it's a very different perspective of the coast and a different embodied, I would say, memory perhaps and celebration that is more around flourishing and abundance. But that view again is being, is of course changed over the years as a lot of the water that now fuels urban expansion along the coast comes from these rivers. They're being extracted again, you know, so it's, and feeds also the other extractive industries, you know, so it's again the landscape being scripted in different ways and how then this gets embodied by a different positioned people is for me also very interesting to try and understand
how the position of the group determines whether the same landscape is absolutely flourishing, whereas the settlers who come with the colonial interest look at it as something that's quite arid and hostile.
If I could perhaps just add a last point, I think just an important interjection.
Yeah.
I'm sure Kira can relate here. On top of what I've said as well, of course, there is what makes the coast also fascinating and always interesting is that it is also a space of creolization and hybridity. So as much as we want to talk about indigenous perspectives and settler perspectives, I think what coastal research also brings is that more understanding of the encounter and of more creolized ways of also perceiving the environment. So I think that point has to, you know, I think at least come in debates around heritage and what we mean about inclusion. Because especially, again, we come from this, we still live with this apartheid legacy where people were really essentialized in terms of this is a settler, this is indigenous, or this is this kind of identity. This is what it means to be Tupinambá. This is what it means to be Afrikaner. But the coast provides this fertile space where actually there are really a lot of erased creolization that happened in these spaces.
So what I think your projects help us understand more than anything for people who are not from Southern Africa or who don't study it is that it's the environment there from both sides or from all the sides is the space of merging and encounter. And maybe these encounters are not always soft. There's a lot of conflict in there. How does the story of the body play out in that context in KwaZulu-Natal, Kira? Or like what came out in Lalela in particular?
I think what Elsamay just said is actually very important because, you know, the erasure of people's lives that colonialism attempted to do as a form of control, one thing that's important, I think, now is that we also don't try and erase this particular kind of what it means to be South African today, because this history has shaped us all in many ways. Yeah, and perhaps what has been useful, I think, with Lalela is that as you happen to have a kind of movement that's being, not that it's just started, but it's getting wider public interest against oil and gas in the oceans in South Africa, that we don't fall into the trap of romanticizing some sort of, canon of indigeneity versus a canon of science. I've always found it interesting when, and it happens often with Lalela, an audience member stands up and goes, oh, I didn't know that the sea was also important to, and you could really use any racial category here that people want to use, like, you know, to white people. I didn't know why people cared about it in this way, or I didn't realize that people's ancestors are thought to live there. I didn't know that. And so it does, as I said before, it just allows not for the erasure of difference. That is really a type of violence in itself, but a recognition of difference and also the possibilities of finding shared concerns and wanting to work together, so that you're not forced back into these essentialist identities that you know many who live here still want to use to retain privilege and power.
Yeah, and the way that the ocean is the catalyst of these stories, that it's subject to challenges of extractionism and of these difficult histories and violent and often violent and racial and racialized and racist histories. The way that ocean acts as a conduit around which all of it swirls comes incredibly strongly in Lalela.
Just wanted to add that the one thing, I mean, Elsa May is an anthropologist, so you know this well, that culture, of course, is a beautiful part of how we make sense of the world, and it can also be an oppressive method in which we start to define what you should and shouldn't think about the world. So part of what I think the arts-based methods can do is they refuse a simplistic storytelling, let's put it that way. And that's good. And in fact, even you can use it to refuse representation, to refuse to have these narrow forms of representation and demand that we think in more complex, richer narrative ways around what meaning is.
I think this is an absolutely perfect note to wrap this conversation up. I think that I just want to let this point breathe and just say, in addition, that we are going to link the new short film about the Topnar in the description of this podcast episode, as well as the animation iteration of Lalela Umwandle. And I would like to thank you both very, very much on this inspiring and illuminating conversation about the interrelations of ocean and humankind through transdisciplinarity and arts-based method. So thank you both so much, Kira and Elsumi.
Thank you, both of you. I really enjoyed the talk.
Thank you, everyone. Bye.
This is the One Ocean Hub podcast.